following is an interview with John K. Andrews, Jr., Deputy Special Assistant to the President. The interview was conducted by Susan Yao on December 3, 1973, in room 487 of the old Executive Office Building.
Raise
the telephone, turn on the high-tension
lamp, and you're up. Right. Actually, we have had a couple of quirk accidents with our own tapes. I can understand why somebody might make a mistake sometime with a tape. I had one very unfortunate interview which did not record through the entire interview. You had to go
Isn't
back.
That terrible? It's like dictating something that's, you need done in a hurry.
And it was something like the day before Christmas. It was, a bad time for both of us to be sitting down and talking about whatever, but it turned out pretty well.
All right, well, we're recording, right?
Right.
Would you like me to just give you kind of a monologue?
That would be
on
great.
What I've
if
done.
You can start.
And then you can.
When you might start from when you were at the press office.
Right.
First. Just for the record, though, when did you first join the staff?
I joined the staff officially. My first day of work was the 19th of January, 1970, okay. The day before the first anniversary of the President's inauguration. My position was simply that of a personal aide to the press secretary, Ron Ziegler. Could best be described in the generic term of the Nixon White House staff that I was Higby for Ron Ziegler, involving organizing his schedule, helping to move papers across his desk, keep his workday running smoothly and efficiently, setting up appointments, doing a little bit of speech writing, handle a lot of his correspondence, and. Just worked generally in that area of keeping him organized personally. I didn't have any responsibilities with regard to press relations as such. And I did that, essentially that same job or function for 1 year and was succeeded by Diane Sawyer. And in February 1971, I joined the what was then called the Writing and Research Staff, now called the Editorial Department. Ray Price had just taken over as the department head, the President's chief speechwriter, with the departure of Jim Keough in December 1970. And he was reorganizing, recasting the staff somewhat, and my writing talents had come to his attention, so he invited me to join that staff. And that was February 1971, and I've worked it relatively in the same position continuously up to this time. My title was that of staff assistant from the time that I joined the press staff, and I was made a deputy special assistant to the President in June or July of this year. Mm-hmm. I might add that my Superior changed from Ray Price to Dave Gergen in January 1973. And so officially he's a special assistant and I'm a deputy under him right now. Now, I can go on and talk about...
First of all, how were you first recruited for the White House job with the press office?
I had been released a year early from the U.S. Navy in October 1969. This happened on short notice. I really wasn't prepared to decide what I wanted to do in civilian life. But I cast around for jobs in journalism and was hired onto the Kansas City Star as a beginning reporter, and was in Kansas City and only a week away from actually starting work there. Without my knowledge, John Ehrlichman, who is a family friend, had given my name to Ron Ziegler as a potential assistant for him. And Mr. Ziegler called me out of the clear blue sky, it was quite a shock, and asked me if I'd be interested in discussing this job. So I came to Washington just about precisely 4 years ago this time, the 2nd of December 1969, was interviewed by Ron Ziegler, and about a week later was notified that he wanted me to join his staff.
So who preceded you as his assistant?
He really didn't have an assistant, and it was a void in the organization. And organization is not his forte. And he needs someone to do the organizing chores for him, and hadn't had anyone for the first year and felt that void. The person who had come the closest to filling this kind of a responsibility was Alan Woods, who had been with the campaign and was with the press office through April 1970, then went out and helped Kit Bond get elected state auditor of Missouri and subsequently governor of Missouri, and he now works for Bond.
Did you do any briefing at all when you were in the press office?
No, never at all.
You were more with the organization.
That's right. I helped with the care and feeding of reporters on trips occasionally, although I did not travel a great deal. I was pretty much based in Washington, and as a matter of fact, Ron liked to have me holding things down when the rest of the staff was in San Clemente or Key Biscayne particularly. The only trip that I took during my period in the press office was that I did accompany Ziegler when he went with the president in September and October 1970 to Italy, Yugoslavia, Spain, England, and Ireland. And also, I guess I did go to Mexico in July or August of that year, too, when the president was down there for a couple days.
Did you act as coordinator for the entire press office in the sense of handling personnel matters and assignments?
No, I didn't. I never did that. Ron was talking about moving me into that kind of position, but before that evolved, I moved over to the writing staff instead.
When you did move over to the writing staff, was there a particular area that was intended for you to fill?
Well, no. The organization of the writing staff has always been that the whole crew is generalists, and everyone just takes on assignments as they come, depending on who is free to take them on. And this has been the setup ever since I've been there. And we never really have developed specialties very much.
So did you end up filling any particular
No,
area?
Not really. I was just sort of put into the general pitching rotation and started out on suggested remarks and minor occasions for the president when he probably was not going to be speaking from a text. That was in the midst of the legislative message season, and I was involved in writing a number of messages at first. The first actual speech that I worked on for the president and worked personally with him was April 1970 when he addressed the annual convention of the DAR. And then you know, that I don't want to say April 71. Then through that year, I increasingly moved into a position where I had opportunities to work on the major presidential speeches as well as the minor occasions, which are, of course, the bulk of the kind of work that's done down there.
Could you describe the steps that the speechwriter staff would go through? I imagine that it would be different for different speeches, but did one person on the speechwriter staff handle the entire speech for a major speech? Or
yes, there's virtually never a collaboration on a speech. It's assigned to one writer, usually assigned by the department head. Occasionally, the president will designate an individual that he wants to handle it. But usually, the speech is assigned within the office. And then that writer works with the department head or editor in producing a draft and, of course, consults with the necessary substantive people on the staff. And when the draft is considered to be in sufficiently good shape, then it goes into the president. And sometimes the writer will be brought in to work with the president in the office to get his thoughts on how to polish the speech. On other occasions, and this is more the rule, the president will simply indicate his comments in writing or will phone the writer or perhaps will phone the department head with his thinking. And it evolves that way, and most speeches go through 6 to 8 drafts, and it's not unusual for the bigger, more important ones to go up to 12 to 15 drafts, State of the Union messages and major TV addresses and so forth.
Did you work on many speeches for or messages for people other than the president?
Well, I've always maintained I've been on retainer from Ron Ziegler, you might say, to occasionally do speeches and other writing projects for him. Recently, I've been in an arrangement where I've done a good deal of writing for Ann Armstrong. Just in the last few months, our staff has taken on more writing for members of the senior staff, such as Mrs. Armstrong, Mr. Harlow, Mr. Laird, General Haig. I've also written speeches or ghosted articles for Herb Klein. I worked on a few things for Vice President Agnew. Did a few things for Henry Cabot Lodge. Really, a good summary of the range of work I've done is included in that inventory of files. Those are the people that have come to mind immediately, though, other than the president for whom I've done things. And recently, our staff has been producing a lot of material for Mr. Ford, and I've done some of that, too. I also was involved in convention preparations in the summer of 72 and wrote some materials for the keynote presentation, particularly, and also for the platform.
How much of a say would someone on the speechwriter staff have in forming the actual substance of the speech, not necessarily in defining what policy the administration is going to stand on, but in even choosing the topic of a speech, which for the DAR,
if you've got a good idea, you can count on that idea getting a fair consideration. Most of the time, a given speech forum self-evidently dictates what the president will talk about. He always usually talks about what's number one in the mind of the country or the mind of that audience, not something relatively obscure that he would choose to bring up. But as far as how the subject is approached, any new twists that can be put on it to dramatize the points that he wants to make, there's a great deal of leeway for an imaginative, creative offering by the writer to gain acceptance. I find that people, and this might be well to say for the record, I find that some people think that a speechwriter, that the whole business of speechwriting is a little dishonest or unsavory, and that it involves people relatively junior and inexperienced like myself, essentially putting words into the mouth and ideas into the head of someone like the president with very little check on how good my words and ideas really are. This is totally a misconception because the president and the top staff people do go over a very very rigorously everything that we prepare for them in writing or that they would use as a speech. And the writer's job is just the opposite of putting his ideas into the president's head. The writer's job is to get the president's ideas into his own head to the extent that you can be an alter ego for him. His speeches would obviously be best if he could write all of them himself. He doesn't have time to, although he does more of his own speech writings than any president since Woodrow Wilson, and he's probably better at it than most of them have been. But he simply doesn't have time to, and the reason that he needs a staff of writers is to have people who can get on his wavelength, who know how he would talk about a given subject, and really there's an element of mind reading involved in the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the real challenges and gratifications of the job, is when you write a draft and you find that it comes back with very few marks on it from the president. That doesn't mean that you've shoved your ideas down his throat. It means that you've succeeded in tuning in on his thinking well enough that you've done it as he would have done it himself.
Mm-hmm. How frequent was your personal contact with the president? We do the daily log.
Yeah, it was very sporadic. It was very sporadic. The period during which I had the most frequent contact with him was April through June 1972. What circumstances moved me into the position of his favored writer during this period, I really don't know. But it started out at the beginning of April. I worked on a speech for him to give on the aid to non-public school question before a Catholic Educators Convention in Philadelphia. Later in April, I was called upon to help him with the television report to the nation on the U.S. response to the so-called Easter Offensive of North Vietnam. Then early in May, he had to go on television again to announce the mining and bombing in North Vietnam, and I was again called upon to help with that speech, and was actually called up to Camp David under very secret circumstances, because the fact that there was even going to be a speech was a very closely guarded secret at that time. And between those two Vietnam speeches, I was called upon to write his nationally televised eulogy for J. Edgar Hoover. And so with all of this momentum, as he looked at his preparations for the trip to the Soviet Union, it was decided that he wanted three writers instead of two, and so Sapphire and Price were already going, and I was added to the trip just a week before we left, and my function on the trip was to be preparing the report that he would give to the nation when he returned to the joint session of Congress, actually, and so I went on that trip and had the opportunity to work on that speech and work closely with him in the later stages of the trip, particularly on the plane coming back from Warsaw to Washington on the 1st of June, polishing that speech. And then I was also included, along with Ray Price, up at Camp David for the better part of a week prior to the time the president went down to the convention last summer to give his acceptance speech. Price and I were up there as on call to help him with the acceptance speech. It turned out to be one of the projects that he did all by himself and wouldn't let anybody else see it. So we played a lot of tennis. That period was really the height of my contacts with the president. And as I say, it's been very sporadic. I ran into him in the hall in the West Wing last night, and it struck me that it was, I think, that only the second time in 1973 that I'd even spoken to the man. although I still have had a number of assignments which involve writing for him. Mm-hmm. So it just goes in fits and starts.
When you're not in contact with him, then your feedback is in the form of his notes on the draft.
That's right, or occasionally telephone calls.
What about, I know you were not hired for any particular area that all the speech writers mm-hmm. are generalists, as you said, but did you evolve into any particular field
specialty
of expertise?
Some of the major areas in which I worked were DC affairs, drugs, bicentennial, environment, agriculture, foreign affairs and defense policy to an extent. That would be less than the others that I mentioned. Executive reorganization. I think that covers the major ones. Oh, youth affairs, education, those are the major ones.
Well, in looking at the topics of that list, obviously then you would have had to have had frequent contact with quite a variety of people in
yes.
the administration.
Yes.
Outside of the speechwriter's office, were there particular offices where you had consistent contact, not necessarily when working on a particular speech?
Well, in that category, I'd include the press office, where I've maintained a more than simply official relationship of contacts and communications because of the personal friendships I developed over there, and I consulted rather frequently with Ron Ziegler and Jerry Warren and others on their staff. I was in fairly consistent touch with John Ehrlichman and the domestic council people working under him. Also fairly consistent contact with the NSC people, usually at the level of Dr. Kissinger's deputy, first Al Haig, and more recently General Scowcroft. Although occasionally working with Dr. Kissinger himself, and very often with some of their top staff people like Sonnenfeld and Winston Lord. And not very much with congressional relations. Another area I didn't mention when you asked who else I'd written for, I did quite a bit of writing for Julie for a period in late 71, early 72, a little bit for Tricia, a little bit for Mrs. Nixon. So I have had fairly consistent contact with people over there in the East Wing. I think that as far as the staff relationships, that's the bulk of it. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever have the opportunity to recommend that a speech be scheduled? I know that that's handled by the appointments office, but would...
No, I was never involved in that at all.
Would you ever be in the position of just making recommendations on
I could have,
the
and
need
other,
for...
Yeah, I could have, and other writers did, but I just never did that I can recall, ever.
What about your public exposure, personally?
Oh, I'd say I had a moderate amount of it. I've been on call to talk to some of the youth seminar types of groups that are always coming through Washington, the close-up program. And there was another program on the Hill, Congressional Classroom or something like that. Presidential Scholars. I've been on a kind of a speakers bureau maintained by the Alumni Association of my college, Principia College, and I've done a number of talks around the country to groups taking off from my experience at the White House. But I haven't had any kind of a heavy speaking schedule at all.
These have been more speaking to smaller groups.
That's right. That's right.
Formal speeches.
That's not. It hasn't been the kind of thing that would get any news coverage or anything like that.
Were there any other? Were there any times when you actually did get involved as a result of working on speech in the actual policy making areas?
Well, this is a fascinating.
It's a difficult thing to separate.
Well, that's right, and I think most people assume it probably is distinctly separated. What I've found working with speeches, and even more so with legislative messages, is that to an extent the writers, although we may not have any greater command of the language than a lot of other people who don't consider themselves writers by trade, for better or worse, we are regarded almost as sorcerers or word wizards in a way that we can get an idea down in language and feel confident about it in a way that other people, although they might state it just as well, aren't confident because it wasn't done by a quote, a writer. Mm-hmm. So we find that the policy people, particularly some of the domestic council people, when there's a range of views among OMB and departments and domestic council as to how a particular issue ought to be tackled, will hold off on their final decisions to wait to see how it looks on paper when we've got it down. And so it wouldn't be right to say that writers find themselves making policy by any means, but you come into an issue where you're very much a layman. You try to acquaint yourself with it intelligently and make the best sense of it you can, and then make a statement about it that looks to you like it'll hold water. And then you give this over to the policy people, and they'll either conclude that what they thought was good won't stand up when it's on paper, or something that they really hadn't thought much of before may look better than they expected it to when you get it on paper. So you do, we find we have an action-forcing role and a thought-clarifying role for some of these other staff people.
Could you pinpoint any particular areas where you do think that your work did influence the actual policy being stated, influence the decision?
Not very many come to mind. I was involved with a very controversial veto of the Child Development Bill in December 1971. Where it was generally agreed that the bill ought to be vetoed for programmatic and budgetary reasons. It was not sound, and it had in it the seeds of becoming an enormously expensive federal program. However, there was also a view spearheaded by Pat Buchanan that the president ought to veto it more on ideological grounds, that the whole child care concept and child development concept represented a threat to the primacy of the family as an institution. And there were advocates of putting a lot of real scare language into the veto about what a socialistic program this could turn out to be. In a word, the question was whether we would demagogue the veto or whether we would write it on a straight programmatic veto it on the merits. And a little bit of demagoguery is an essential ingredient in effective presidential communications as far as I'm concerned. It's just necessary to dramatize issues. I don't mean any more by demagoguery than that. Although it sometimes does get out of hand and go beyond that. But I wrote the early drafts of that veto message, and then Buchanan, as he frequently does, he's really good at working to get his way within the staff. Buchanan struck with drafts of his own, which were radically different in their arguments from the ones that I had been making. And we ended up having a sort of a head-knocking session where it was all sorted out over in Ken Cole's office one day with John Ehrlichman presiding and Buchanan and I shouting at each other. in friendly spirit. And I think we came out with a 50-50 compromise on the thing, or maybe 60-40 on the side of those of us that felt the demagoguery should be downplayed. So that's an example of the process I'm talking about. At the same period, really almost the same week, December 1st, 1971, the president addressed the National 4-H Congress in Chicago. And I had been, as I said earlier, very interested in youth affairs, and I felt that not enough had been done to exploit the natural constituency that the president enjoyed among a lot of young people who may not have been as vocal, but who did admire a lot of the things that he stood for. And I wanted to use that speech as an occasion for the president to state a conciliatory, creative, new policy toward young people, and also to give a very vigorous defense of what the administration had already done on behalf of young people, because we were looking into an election year when the youth vote was going to be a factor for the first time. And I had a lot of success in casting, I think, the president in a new role relative to young people from what he had ever been perceived as before. And this may sound like it contradicts with what I said before, that the writer doesn't properly and doesn't in fact manipulate his client, whether the president or anyone else. But I don't feel that this was an instance of manipulation. I feel it was an instance of playing up elements in the president's own philosophy and his record, which simply hadn't been highlighted sufficiently before, and of working to bridge between his administration and young people where the bridges could be built, rather than emphasizing the points of difference, which had been done too much. So those are a couple of examples. Another example, and it happened to again to involve Buchanan and me, although we're by no means natural adversaries or anything, was this Catholic educator speech in early April 72 that I mentioned earlier, where that was a case in reverse on the child development veto. I had been in on it first, and then he came in the late going with a new version. In the Catholic educators, he had written the early versions, and the domestic people felt he got the president too far out on a limb relative to promises about aid to non-public schools. And so Ehrlichman said he wanted me to write a competing draft that would head off Buchanan at the pass. And again, it came down to a compromise where the two of us both had an input into the final product.
How frequently were two people assigned to write drafts for the same speech?
Not very often. The instances that I've mentioned were definitely the exception and not the rule.
Did you have any kind of assistant to help you do the background research, or did you rely on the research staff?
No, we've got the research staff attached to our office down there, and everyone in the office makes use of them. The only person in the office that's really in relation as a personal assistant to another member of the staff has been the assistant to the department head, which was Keough had no assistant. Dave Gergen was an assistant to Price before he took over, and Ann Morgan has more recently been an assistant to Dave Gergen.
What about your secretary?
I started out sharing a secretary with Lee Huebner. Well, first of all, in the press office, I just kind of worked with the regular staff secretaries over there. In the writing staff, I shared a secretary with Lee Huebner. Her name is Melinda Morey. She left the writing staff in the spring of 71 and went to work for John Ehrlichman. And I can't think where she is now. Then from spring 71 until February 73, My secretary was Lillian Cox, whom we brought over from the White House Conference on Youth. And I actually shared her with Tex Lazar. Then Lazar moved out of our immediate staff with Ray Price last February, and I brought in a former co-worker of Lily Cox's from the youth conference by the name of Tony Hodges, who has been my secretary since then.
Another more technical thing. Other than the files which you maintain, which you're sending to central files that are listed in the inventory, would there be any other offices which would have any significant amounts of not your files per se, but
papers,
of material papers relating to your work? I assume that speech drafts that the
various speech drafts
commented on were sent.
Have always been retained by Rose
by
Woods.
Rose Woods.
The copies of drafts of various speeches and messages would be on file with some of the substantive offices, OMB, Domestic Council, NSC, that happened to have been involved with them, but they would only, they would not supplement what's on file with Gergen. They would only overlap and duplicate that. And as I noted in that memo, everything I worked on in my year with Ron Ziegler was integrated with his files. And so there may be papers in there that have my name on them. I'm sure there are, although not a lot. Otherwise, there would be no place that I could think of where much that I worked on would be stored.
One thing I didn't ask you, when you were working with Ziegler, did you draft a lot of his just routine daily correspondence? And
yes, I did a great deal of it. That was turned over to Agnes Waldron when I left that office. I don't know if she still does it. I think she does. He gets more mail, or did at that time, than anyone in the White House except the president himself, because his name was in the news so much. And a lot of people that might otherwise write to the president with their good wishes or their complaint or whatever also end up directing it to Ron Ziegler. So we had an enormous volume of mail to answer and referrals on substantive matters and so forth, and I handled a lot of that. And so for the year 1970, a lot of what has his signature on it was my draft. And a great many staff memoranda as well.
This is maybe difficult with such a short perspective, but are there any particular areas that you worked in which gave you more satisfaction, whether it be because of the input to your the youth message that you were speaking about, or something even more general than that?
It's difficult to single anything out. I've gained enormous satisfaction from the whole experience. But I really couldn't comment in detail. I think I do need more perspective before I can, the peaks and valleys will stand out more clearly.
Well, in the same kind of question, are there any areas that you can think of your work here which would not be well documented from your files or from other files which exist in the complex that should be brought out in something like a future Nixon Oral History Project? Either specific items or comments on how the White House works, kind of.
No, I think the nature of my work, because it has involved putting things on paper, there is a pretty good documentary record of whatever contributions I have made. And when I've had an idea or a particular point of view to argue about how the White House was handling something, I've usually been fairly forthright in putting it in a memo to Bob Haldeman or Ron Ziegler or Ray Price or someone like that, and those would be on file with them.
So that the thought process
from the early stages would be on
that's
paper.
That's right, that's right.
You did keep the early drafts that you did before finally handing
over to
Preston.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The practice in the writing staff is to have a step-by-step record from the very first draft of everything that we do, and so this is all in the files that I've inventoried.
Were there any particular magazine or any published articles on either you in particular or on the speechwriter staff which you felt were particularly good in describing the role of your office or of you?
Well, I've received very little publicity myself. The staff has been written up once in Washingtonian in mid-1971, as I recall. Was written up last year in National Journal at quite some length, and both of those are good articles.
National Journal is usually very good, I think.
The only objection I had to National Journal was that since this is all being buried in the archives, I will say it. John McLaughlin has been passing himself off as one of the president's speechwriters for about 2 years now, and it's all a giant hoax. And in that National Journal article, with his typical instinct for good self-promotion, he managed to make himself look like a key member of the writing staff, and he never has been that. He's operated out of the writing staff, using it as a base, doing very little writing, and he's done a lot of speaking, and probably quite effectively so on the president's behalf, but he is not, and never has been, a speechwriter.
Do you know why he was assigned to the speechwriter staff?
Well, Ray Price hired him in mid-71. McLaughlin had been an unsuccessful Republican candidate for the Senate from Rhode Island in 1970. He had been an editor for the Jesuit Weekly or Monthly America, and had some writing credentials and political credentials, and Price hoped that McLaughlin could become a real right hand for him, a deputy for him, but it, for various reasons, it just didn't pan out. I don't want to put anything catty into the record like that. But it just happens to be a matter of fact that although this fellow may have been useful to the president in his way, the idea that he's a speechwriter just happens to be miscast.
Mm-hmm. Where are you going when you leave the staff?
I'm going to be joining a national organization called Adventure Unlimited, which conducts a Christian ministry for teenagers around this country and in some areas overseas. The denominational base of the organization is Christian Science, but it reaches out to a broad variety of teenagers. About 100 cities, and I'm going to become director of communications for them.
Do you have a permanent forwarding address where you might be reached even over the next 10 years or
long-term? I would say that through that organization, they will always be able to reach me even if I'm not working there anymore. And that is Adventure Unlimited, 200 South Sheridan Boulevard, Denver, Colorado, 80226. That's starting in January.
80226.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing. I should have asked you this the other day when you were out. Do you have a biographical sketch which we could just keep in the file? A resume, any kind of.
I'll send you a resume. And because you mentioned if there have been any articles written on me. There may have been, or there is one particularly that I can think of that might be of some small use to you, so I can send you a copy of that too.
Okay, we do try and maintain a vertical file of just who's who on the staff.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I'm happy to include that in there. Unless there's something else you'd like to add, as I said, we're trying to go briefly over.
No, I think I've covered it pretty much.
So that hopefully when names come up, whether it be a researcher or just an archivist organizing papers, that
uh-huh.
you know where to fit people
yeah.
in the scheme of things. And then hopefully at some point we'll have the opportunity to do a much more in-depth oral history project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd be delighted to take part in that.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
And hopefully one of these days you will receive a transcript of this, as I said.
Oh, no, I won't hold my breath.
No, it will be a while.